This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Most of us who've parented adolescents will tell you it can be challenging for both sides as young adults test and stretch boundaries. What is it about this phase of life which prompts experimentation? Why is self-control a challenge and peer pressure so hard to fight? This hour, we take a look at the science behind the adolescent brain. Our guest, Lauren Steinberg, is a professor of psychology at Temple University and author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. Lauren Steinberg, welcome back to Radio Times.
Thanks very much.
So let's get to the op-ed article in the New York Times this Sunday. As many parents know, adolescence now seems to last longer than it ever has. And you've said in that op-ed article that might not be such a bad thing.
Right. So the typical 25-year-old today is twice as likely as his or her parents' generation was to be a student at that age, and only half as likely to be married, and 50% more likely to still be receiving financial assistance from parents. So it's clearly taking people longer to become adults, at least by the conventional definition of adulthood. And, there's a lot of hand-wringing about that.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't our kids growing up as fast as they should, as fast as we did? Why aren't they doing what we were doing when we were that age? But I think what we're learning from the new science of adolescence is that taking your time to go through adolescence might not be such a bad thing for your brain or for your mental health. The brain is very plastic during adolescence. It's very malleable. And one of the things that keeps it malleable is exposure to novelty and challenge. Once we leave adolescence and become adults, we often stop putting ourselves in situations that are new or that are challenging. And one of the things that does, we think, is that it closes the window of brain plasticity. So it might not be such a bad thing to move through adolescence at a somewhat slower pace as long as you're in circumstances and situations that continue to expose you to things that are good for your brain.
What is it about our culture that seems to prompt adolescence to last such a long time?
I think it's mainly the economy and changes in the labor force. I think there are some stories in popular media that provide disparaging portraits of people in their 20s, that they're often presented as self-absorbed slackers who are taking their time because they can. But I think if you look at the data, what you see is that it just requires so much more education to get a decent paying job. Until fairly recently, having a couple of years of college or even an associate's degree gave you an advantage in the labor force over somebody who had just a high school diploma. But that advantage has pretty much disappeared. You really need a college degree now to reap the investment that college requires. And, what we call a four-year degree now takes an average of 6 years.
Yeah.
So most people are not finishing their education until, 24, 25 years old. And from an economic point of view, that's a really good thing. But if you're going to stay a student until you're 25, you're probably going to be requiring financial assistance from mom and dad, and you're probably going to not be thinking about getting married yet, certainly not be thinking about becoming a parent. So all of those markers of adulthood are becoming delayed. But I think the driving force is the economy.
So in your book, you offer a lot of advice to parents. For the parents who are saying, okay, my adult child is 24, 25, and they're still going through the process of becoming young adults, perhaps the parents a little impatient, what would you advise to the families to work together as in this extended period of adolescence?
I think the most important thing probably is to not judge your child on the basis of these categories that we tend to put people in. Like, is my child still living at home? Or is my child still trying to find herself in terms of what she's going to do with her work life? And instead, I would look at, how is my young adult child spending her time? What is he doing day to day? If I had a child that age living at home who was just sitting around watching talking cats on YouTube all day long, I would worry.
Mm.
But if I had a child who was pursuing a career in a field that required a lot of education and maybe that didn't pay so well, but that was a a good career and an interesting one, I wouldn't hesitate to support that young person while this avenue of work is being pursued.
Okay. You also say that American teens are at risk. In general, they're not doing well when compared to peers from other parts of the world. Could you get into that a little bit for us?
Yeah. You know, if you look at these international achievement comparisons that are done annually, American high school students are invariably near the bottom of the list. And what's perplexing about that is that our elementary school students are typically at the top of the list, and our middle school students are kind of in the center of the distribution. So it does seem to be specific to our high school students. But it's not just poor achievement. We lead the developed world in things like adolescent obesity or binge drinking or STDs or violence. So, you know, I think it's clear that we're not doing what we need to do to raise a happy and healthy and competent generation of young people. And I think we really need to think differently about raising and educating and how we treat kids in American society, because I think we're doing things that are wrong.
Do they have too much American teens?
I'm not sure that the problem fundamentally is that they're spoiled or coddled. I think it's that they're not demanded to do hard things, difficult things. Our schools are very, very easy compared to high schools in the rest of the world. So in those achievement comparisons where our high school students fare so poorly, they often include questionnaires for kids as well from all over the world that ask them about different aspects of their life. And we rank very high on the list in terms of kids' ratings of school as boring. We're third in the world, I think. Only one out of every six American high school students says that she's ever taken a difficult or challenging class. Only one out of six, ever. I mean, this is not good. So our kids are bored in school. And the fact that we're not challenging them, not demanding very much from them, has more than academic consequences. We've talked a lot over the last couple of years about the importance of building what some experts call non-cognitive skills, things like determination and perseverance, grit even. And those things develop in response to challenge, in response to novelty, in response to placing demands that the brain do a little bit more than what the brain previously was capable of. So if we're not demanding much from our kids at school, they're not going to develop those characteristics. They're not going to develop things like self-control. And that's so important, not just for success in school, but it's also important for things like deterring experimentation with drugs and alcohol or deterring criminal behavior, violent behavior.
So why in America, if I'm hearing you correctly, at the elementary level, at the middle school level, the kids are pretty much on par with their peers in the rest of the world. Why in high school, culturally, what is happening in that the high school system is not challenging kids? Why the drop-off?
I can't explain it. It doesn't seem to have to do with the usual suspects when we have discussions about school reform. So teachers who teach at the secondary school level are typically better prepared. They're paid more. We spend more per capita educating high school students than elementary or middle school students. I think that we have become lazy about what we do in American high schools, and as a consequence, they have become places for socializing, you know, where all those bothersome things like classes get in the way of what you really want to be doing with your time there, meeting up with and hanging out with your friends. That's what we hear from our own students. 70% of American high school students say that they would learn more in school if their schools had higher standards. I think that's very telling that our own students are saying that about our secondary education.
And are you hearing from them that they want to learn more, that they want to be challenged?
Yes. One of the most common complaints of adolescents, as you know, is I'm bored. And there is almost nothing more boring in the United States than an American high school.
If you had to help a young person develop grit, how would you do that?
I think you want to have kids be challenged to the point where they fail occasionally. And failure
is not acceptable in this society quite often. It's almost
right.
a four-letter word.
Right. We don't want our kids to fail because we're very worried about having our kids feel bad. But it's only through failing and then learning how to work harder the next time that people develop grit and determination. So if we don't challenge our kids to do more, to do better, then they won't have opportunities to learn how to do even better the next time. Now, I know that there are listeners out there who think that their kids are under tremendous stress and a lot of pressure in school. And there are kids across the country who are in very demanding schools, who are taking a lot of AP classes,
sure.
who are under a lot of stress. That's a very small minority, relatively speaking. And we don't want to challenge kids so much that they're stressed out by it. So it's finding that right point where, it's scaffolding it, really, where you're pushed a little bit more than what you're capable of doing, but not so much that it's overwhelming.
Let's get back to failure for just a moment. Failure and self-esteem, they're not mutually exclusive?
No. I think we in American culture, and I'm certainly not the only person to say this, we worry too much about our kids' self-esteem. Self-esteem comes out of competence. It comes out of succeeding at things that we know are difficult and challenging. It comes out of overcoming obstacles. That's how you build self-esteem.
Okay. You write that American adolescents are, as you mentioned before, among the most frequent binge drinkers, users of illegal drugs in the world. And yet my understanding is they're being taught about alcohol and drugs in school. So where's the disconnect there?
Health education, as it's practiced typically through classroom-based instruction, is very effective at changing what kids know, but it's not very effective at changing how they act. As I discuss in the book, there are changes in the brain that take place during early adolescence that arouse the brain's reward centers. It actually makes good things feel even better. I mean, this is one of the effects of sex hormones on the brain. Honestly, nothing will ever feel as good to you for the rest of your life as it did when you were a teenager, when these reward mm-hmm. centers were so easily aroused. And one of the things that happens because these reward centers are aroused is that kids pursue activities that are exciting, that they think are going to be pleasurable, even if there are risks and dangers involved. And so what happens is that informing them of what the risks and dangers are doesn't really deter them from pursuing them, partly because at the time when the brain's reward centers are being so easily activated, kids are still developing self-control.
All right. We're going to get into that a little bit more in just a moment, but we're up against a break. Lawrence Steinberg is our guest this hour. He's a developmental psychologist specializing in adolescence and is the author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. If you have questions about parenting teens, here's the number, 888-477-9499, or send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Back in just a moment.
Support for WHYY comes from Beck Institute for Cognitive Behavior Therapy. Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck welcome new clients to their Center for Psychotherapy in Bala Cynwyd. Beck Institute is committed to providing effective, problem-focused, and compassionate treatment for issues such as anxiety, depression, stress, and weight management. To learn about cognitive behavior therapy or to schedule an appointment, beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020.
Hi, I'm filmmaker Ken Burns. You choose WHYY because you appreciate the shows it delivers every day, because it offers something different. WHYY provides trustworthy news coverage, offers a gateway to the arts, and educates viewers and listeners of all ages with support from individuals like you. Visit WHYY.org or call 888-345-9499. And as always, thank you.
Widener University supports WHYY and offers over 60 graduate degree programs, including physical therapy, business administration, education, and more. Widener graduate programs are designed to combine challenging and engaging classroom work with experiential learning to help jumpstart your career. Hosting a graduate open house on September 30th from 5 to 7 p.m. Registration available now at widener.edu/grad open house. widener.edu/grad open house. Widener Leadership Works.
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain, and this is Radio Times from WHYY in Philadelphia. And this hour, we're looking at brain science and adolescence with Lawrence Steinberg. He's a professor of psychology at Temple University and author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. As always, we invite you to join the conversation. The number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email if you like at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And Lawrence, getting into the break, we were talking about the fact that you can tell kids that something is not bad for you, but sometimes you just see that glazed over look, you know, and you know that the message is going right over the tops of their heads. And how do you get the message across, and how do you begin to develop self-control in a teenager, or help them to begin to develop self-control?
I think you do want to try to get the message across, but I think that just providing information isn't enough. Even if the message gets in there, when kids are caught up in the moment, especially when they're with their friends, they're not drawing on that information. We can talk about it more later if you want. This is what we study in our lab at Temple, the impact of peers on risky decision making. So then what should we do? I mean, what can we do to deter our kids from doing these things? It's very important. We've made so much progress in treating disease and illness during adolescence, but yet mortality rates double or even triple between childhood and adolescence. And so the threats to our kids' well-being are not illness or disease. They're things that kids do to themselves and to each other. One of the things that I advocate is thinking about adolescent public health differently and thinking about trying to deter risky and reckless behavior by changing the context rather than by changing the kid. So let me give you a couple of examples of that. We know that the prime time for experimentation with sex, drugs, and delinquent behavior now is between 3 and 6 in the afternoon. And if we put more resources into having structured, supervised after-school activities for adolescents, rather than simply trying to communicate information to them in these health education classes that don't do all that much, we could probably do a lot more to deter kids from engaging in the behaviors we wish that they wouldn't do.
That's interesting. So kind of a different approach. In other words, a more practical approach instead of preaching, perhaps understanding that the time that, you know, the kids would be more likely to do these sort of from 3 to 6 in the afternoon.
Yes, it's not in the back seat of your car. It's in your own basement or the basement of your friends whose parents aren't home.
Yeah.
Another example has to do with diminishing teen smoking. We don't want kids to smoke cigarettes, and we've had some success in driving down the rate of teen smoking. But the success did not come from anti-tobacco education. The success came from raising the price of cigarettes. So again, we're trying to change the world that kids live in rather than trying to make kids into something that's hard to do because, as I explain in the book, evolution has made adolescence a time when we're wired to engage in risky behavior. And as I was saying before, sex hormones change the brain in ways that make us more risk-taking, that make us more sensation-seeking. So I think that trying to turn adolescents into people that don't take risks, it's an uphill battle against evolution and endocrinology, and it's really hard to win.
All right, the phones are lighting up, so let's get to them. Chris in Bala Cynwyd, welcome to Radio Times.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I had a question about ADHD. If Professor Steinberg could tell me if there's been any data or research on how it gets diagnosed, whether it gets overdiagnosed, and consequently, if children are being over-medicated for this. This seems to be something that hits in adolescence anyway.
That's a great question. Thanks, Chris.
The United States accounts for 75% of the world's consumption of ADHD medication, and we certainly don't have 75% of the world's kids with ADHD. So whether it's being over-diagnosed or whether kids are being medicated even without a diagnosis, Either way, it's not very good. I mean, I think that we are using these medications in many instances to help manage the behavior of kids whose behavior worries us and troubles us, but where the root cause is not attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
And boys are primarily frequently diagnosed with ADHD?
Yes, boys are, and boys actually have a higher rate of legitimate ADHD than girls do. But boys are disproportionately likely to be medicated for ADHD when they don't really have ADHD. It goes back to this issue of what's going on in American schools. So many of our schools have armed, guards in them now. And I just think when a society starts resorting to putting, armed police officers in schools and medicating its students so that they sit still, something is really wrong with the way we're educating people.
Let's take a look at, just for a moment, at boys and girls. Do boys learn differently? Should they be educated differently in general?
I don't think so. I think that boys and girls are different. Boys have less self-control, and they don't ever develop the self-control that girls do during adolescence. And at the same time, boys are more likely to engage in risky behavior and sensation-seeking than girls do. So boys are kind of more vulnerable to these problems during adolescence because they have this high sensation-seeking and low self-control. But there isn't any evidence that boys and girls learn differently. And the evidence on brain development suggests that while, of course, there are sex differences in how the brain develops, the differences are small and they're not likely to be of practical significance.
Okay. We've got a comment from Glenn in the Poconos, and we addressed this a little bit earlier in the show, but he says he thinks teens are spoiled and that we live in a world of instant gratification.
Well, those are two different observations. I mean, clearly we live in a world of instant gratification, and clearly something that's important for children to develop is the ability to delay gratification. In fact, of all the traits a person can have in life, self-control is probably the single most important one. It's very predictive of who does well in school, of the quality of your relationships, of your mental health in general. Whether kids are spoiled or not, I'm not so sure. Of course, it's always hard to have data on these kinds of things in the sense that we don't demand very much from them, particularly in school. I suppose one could think of that as spoiling them in some way.
Michael in Mount Airy, you're next and live on Radio Times. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a great conversation. My question or comment, however you want to look at it, is I am not a parent. I'm old enough to be a grandparent, but I'm not a parent. One of the reasons I chose not to be a parent was the contradictions that my parents gave me. My parents would tell me, don't drink, don't do alcohol, don't do drugs, blah, 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 while they were sitting there having a drink, having Valium for their stress, et cetera, et cetera. And then we look at the schools, our children don't do well in schools, and we say, you have to do well, you have to get a good education. And then we turn around and we have debates about selling off the schools in Philadelphia. And closing schools in Philadelphia, and we're just one of many cities doing the same thing.
Yeah, you've got a number of points there, Michael.
Yeah, the contradictions just made me not want to be a parent.
Let's thank you for the call to Radio Times. Do as I say, not as I do.
Well, with respect to alcohol and tobacco in particular, which, after all, are legal for adults to use, and in at least a couple of states, marijuana as well, we do know that the impact of these substances on the adolescent brain is much more harmful than it is on the adult brain. So when adults are telling their kids, look, I enjoy a glass of wine with dinner, but you're too young to be drinking, there is actually some evidence in support of that point of view. Somebody who starts using recreational drugs, whether legal or illegal, before the age of 15 is 7 to 10 times more likely to develop a substance abuse problem or an addiction than somebody who waits until the age of 21. It's not simply because the kind of people that start early are different. We know this from research on animals, where we can randomly assign animals to be exposed to these substances either shortly after puberty, when they are kind of the equivalent of human adolescence, or when they're fully grown adults. And the ones that start younger are much more likely to become addicted to the substance.
What are some signs that your child is struggling? Kids are pretty good at hiding things.
They are. I think that if you notice a change in your child's behavior that worries you, withdrawn behavior, irritability, acting out behavior, a big drop in school performance. If you notice a change in your child's behavior and it goes on for a couple of weeks, you might want to talk to somebody about it. That's a good rule of thumb.
Lauren Steinberg is our guest this hour. He is a developmental psychologist specializing in adolescence and is author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. If you have any questions, feel free to give us a call. Join the conversation. The number is 888-477-9499. Interestingly, you say there has been a real drop in the onset of puberty in this country. Tell us about that.
It's quite dramatic. At the beginning of the 20th century, the average American girl got her first period at around 14 and a half. Today, it's close to 12. And we are seeing reports from pediatricians all over the United States of increasing numbers of young girls, 7 or 8 year old girls, who are showing the early signs of puberty, like breast development. So that's second grade now. And there have been comparable declines for boys. Boys, as most of your listeners know, go through puberty later than girls do, on average about a year and a half later. But there has been a drop over the last century or more in the age of puberty among boys, too. There are three principal reasons for this. Probably the most important is obesity. Kids who are heavier, fatter in particular, go through puberty earlier than kids who are thinner. And as we know, there's been an epidemic of childhood obesity in this country for a long time. So that's one contributor. A second is the exposure of our children to what are called endocrine disruptors. So chemicals in food, in cosmetics, in different kinds of plastics, in pesticides, mm-hmm. that interfere with our normal hormonal functioning and that have hastened the onset of puberty. Then the third, which I think most people don't know because it's pretty new science, is that exposure to light may be increasing the number of kids who start puberty earlier, particularly the kind of light that's emitted from computer screens and tablets and smartphones. We know that in general, kids who are exposed to more light, whether it's natural or artificial, go through puberty earlier. So around the world, children who grew up near the equator go through puberty earlier than children who grew up near the poles, because the ones near the equator have more accumulated time exposed to sunlight. But it turns out that artificial light may play a role as well.
Well, that's fascinating. What are the negative effects, if any, of early onset puberty?
In general, it's bad for you. Among women in particular, it's associated with increased rates of cancer to go through puberty earlier, both breast cancer as well as cervical cancer. There's some evidence that for boys it may elevate the risk of testicular cancer. But there's a lot of research on mental health during adolescence that suggests that early maturation may be stressful in ways that increase rates of depression, particularly in girls, but that also increase rates of problem behavior in both sexes. So early maturing kids are more likely to use drugs and be involved in delinquent behavior and to be sexually precocious. So we don't want our kids to be maturing earlier than has been the norm historically.
Let's get back to the phones. Barbara is standing by in New Hope. Hello, Barbara.
Hi.
Welcome to Radio loving Times.
I'm loving this topic. I'm wondering if the greater amount of estrogen that girls have with their small bit of testosterone and the smaller estrogen and the greater testosterone in boys has any effect on that tempering quality that girls have and that boys do not have.
Interesting question. Thanks for the call.
It certainly is the case that this arousal of reward seeking that we were talking about before, which leads to so much risky behavior and sensation seeking, around the time of puberty and a little bit after that, is due mainly to the impact of testosterone on the brain. So testosterone stimulates activity in the brain involving the neurotransmitter dopamine. Dopamine serves many functions in the brain, but one of its most important ones is the experience of pleasure. I mean, that's what makes us feel good when we are either anticipating something pleasurable or when we are actually engaged in something pleasurable. It doesn't matter whether it's sex or food or praise. It all activates this dopamine system. And testosterone increases the dopamine activity in the brain's reward center. So, yes, you're right that probably accounts for a lot of the sex difference in the behavior of boys and girls in this domain of risky behavior and sensation seeking.
And you also say along those lines, alcohol and many drugs are also associated with the dopamine-like effect with pleasure?
Right. So the molecular structure of a lot of the drugs that we use recreationally resembles dopamine. And so what happens is when you introduce those drugs into the brain, the molecules of the drug attach to the dopamine receptors, and the brain can't tell the difference between these drugs and dopamine. So what starts to happen is that the brain thinks that there's enough dopamine there because it's being tricked by these drugs, and it starts to produce less natural dopamine. This is what causes an addiction. Because as the brain produces less natural dopamine, we look to these substances to make us feel normal, to make us feel normal amounts of pleasure. So it's a vicious cycle. It's especially important to not use these substances early in adolescence, because that's when this brain system is being built. That's when it's still plastic and still subject to the impact of the environment. So if you use a lot of these substances when you're growing up, it's going to permanently affect the way that this part of the brain develops.
All right, we've got time for one more question before we get to our break. Sophie, you're live on Radio Times. Hi.
Yes, hi.
Welcome.
Hello. Hi. I am a young teacher working with a group of youth in Baltimore, and we're working on creating counter ads for underage drinking. My question is, do you think it would be helpful to teach them about how their brains work as adolescents, sort of, you know, in a way that they can understand, so they may realize the difference between drinking, that contradiction, the difference between adults that are drinking and adolescents who are drinking, and how that affects them.
Thanks, Sophie. Lawrence?
I think it's a really good idea. I think it's one approach to a big problem. It won't solve the problem in and of itself, but my experience in talking to groups of high school students is that they are very interested in learning about how their brains are developing, and they do pay attention when you explain to them how these drugs affect their brain development. It's also, I think, a pretty cool way to get kids interested in science and using the adolescent brain as an entry point to discussions about science in general might be a way to get our kids interested in this topic.
All right. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. In for Marty Moskowain, Lawrence Steinberg is our guest. He is author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. And if you have any questions, concerns, thoughts, give us a call at 888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet or as well at WHYY Radio Times. More in just a moment.
Delaware's resident ensemble players support WHYY and present the Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award-winning play Angels in America, Millennium Approaches, September 25th through October 12th. This epic drama is a provocative, witty, and moving account of a circle of friends in the 1980s whose lives are shattered by the emerging AIDS crisis. Jewish, Mormon, gay, straight, black, and white, none are untouched by the impending storm. 302-831-2204 or DelawareRep.org.
Domestic violence has been in the news a lot lately, with videos of a vicious attack being shared on social media. But often the conversation stops as the news story slowly fades from the headlines. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, we'll take an in-depth look at this persistent problem. We'll discuss its causes and prevention. Today at noon on WHYY FM.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase was recognized and highlighted among Philadelphia hospitals for safety and surgical outcomes based on a nationwide study. Surgeons at Fox Chase are fellowship trained with up to 4 years of additional training on the complex techniques of cancer surgery. Part of Temple Health, Fox Chase is committed to patient safety, world-class care, and the best outcomes. Fox Chase Cancer Center, your first choice in cancer care.
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane, and this is Radio Times. This hour, we're looking at brain science in adolescence, and our guest is Lawrence Steinberg, author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. And as always, we invite you to join the conversation. The number is 1-888-477-9499. And you can also send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org if you like. Lawrence, we were talking about this hour, the plasticity of the adolescent brain. And you also say, you've been talking about some of the tougher issues facing teens, but you also say that this is an opportunity to stimulate positive growth. Why don't you get into that a little bit for us?
Sure. So when the brain is plastic or malleable, that refers to its ability to be influenced by experience. And what we've discovered is that adolescence is a second time in development when the brain is exceptionally plastic or malleable. The first is the first few years of life, what we sometimes call 0 to 3. It's been a relatively recent revelation that adolescence is another period of heightened brain plasticity. What this means is that it makes adolescence an opportunity to stimulate positive development by challenge and by demanding that our kids think a little harder, by giving them experiences that are going to help build things like self-control and self-regulation that are so important to success. But it also makes adolescence a time of vulnerability. You know, the brain can't tell the difference between good experiences and bad experiences. So the same malleability of the brain that makes it able to benefit from stimulation also makes it susceptible to toxic experiences. One indication of that is that mental health problems are more likely to have their onset during adolescence than any other time. So the average age of onset for a serious mental illness, if you look across all of them together, is 14.
Why is that?
It's because the brain is very plastic and very susceptible to the environment. It's very stress reactive. A really interesting paper appeared earlier this year on the impact of exposure to war on life expectancy. Right? So growing up during a war takes years off your life, but it takes more years off your life if you're an adolescent than if you're a child or an adult. And that's because the hormonal changes of puberty make the brain more stress responsive. But one of the messages I want to get across in this book is not about the negative aspects of adolescence, but about the positive aspects of adolescence. I'm active in the positive psychology community. And I think we need to start thinking about adolescence not just as something to be survived, but as a time when people can really thrive. If you go to the bookstore and you look in the adolescent section, you're going to see survival guides. And we need a different message out there for parents.
But as parents do, I mean, let's face it, at times you are just trying to survive adolescence, both sides. So what would you say to parents? How do you get them to the point of looking at the positive side and helping their adolescent to thrive as you're going through difficult times?
Well, I think partly it's coming into adolescence with a different view of the period. So we know that parents who enter adolescence with a lot of trepidation and who think that it's going to be a negative time end up creating that. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. We've had studies done of teachers, too, that find the same thing, that teachers who expect the worst from adolescents bring it out in them. So partly it's coming into it expecting it to be a time of growth for the better and not just trying to see if you can endure it in some way. Another is knowing how to respond when your child is having problems, and knowing that a close parent-child relationship is the single most important protection against serious problems developing during adolescence. Look, it is a time of experimentation.
Sure.
And parents, even the best parents, are going to find out that their kids do things that are really dumb. And they're going to have to figure out a way to respond to those things in a way that preserves the quality of the parent-child relationship and maintains the trust that exists.
How do you rebuild trust after a kid does something dumb?
I think you start by not overreacting and exploding. Kids are very sensitive to emotional cues in their environment. And if you're yelling and screaming at your adolescent, what's happening is that your adolescent is paying attention to the volume of your voice and not paying attention to what you're saying. So part of it is to try to have a calm discussion about what was wrong about the adolescent's behavior, what she could have done differently, and what she's going to do the next time, and what the consequences are going to be if she doesn't follow the rules.
All right, to the phones we go. Meg in Bordentown, New Jersey, you're live on Radio Times.
Hi. I had a comment about high school. I think high school is very limited, and it doesn't offer the kids enough opportunities. I encouraged my kids to do things in the community, and they got involved in community theater, which is full of risk-taking. But the other thing is to be the parent who makes things possible. I was willing to drive my kids and other kids to do things. So many parents I know just sort of once they hit high school, they expected that high school would do everything, and they thought they were done. I was the parent who made it possible. I heard great conversations in the back seat of my car that, you know, I learned all kinds of things that was going on with the kids.
Thanks so much for the call to Radio Times. So I see you nodding your head, Lawrence.
I'm so glad for that call. Thank you so much, because you've made several really critical points. The first is that all risk-taking isn't bad. We want our kids to engage in positive risk-taking. We want them to try out for the school play. We want them to take classes where they're not guaranteed to get A's. We want them to tell that somebody special how they really feel about them. So we don't want to discourage risk-taking as a whole. We just want to create a world for our kids in which they can engage in positive risk-taking but are protected against negative risk-taking. The second point that the caller makes that I really love is that we have to help our kids find their passions. Kids can get engaged in all kinds of different things. Some of them get really engaged in school if they go to really good and challenging schools. That's terrific. Others are going to get engaged in the arts, others in music, others in sports. So I really encourage parents to help your adolescent find his passion. And to enable him to experience it and to support him in his pursuit of it.
All right. Continuing with our telephone calls on Radio Times. Emily, you're live. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to call. First of all, thank you for airing this because I feel like it's just not talked about enough.
Thank you.
And I'm a single mother with full custody of a 12-year-old girl. And I really struggle with her weight. You know, I'm very into fitness personally, and I don't apply a lot of pressure just because I don't want the opposite effect. And, you know, I've tried to encourage her in certain ways and motivate her, and I feel like I'm failing at it. And her weight's becoming a problem, and I feel like society is telling her it's okay. It's okay. Don't worry about it. You know, not everybody's fit. And even our pediatrician has really not addressed it when I brought it up to try to get. I want to know what's the best way to attack that, and from a positive standpoint.
Thanks, Emily. Lawrence?
Well, there really are three things that are important to do for the physical well-being of our teenagers, which includes being a healthy weight. The first, you know, and most obvious one is to have healthy foods around the house. I mean, if your cupboards and refrigerator are stocked with junk food, then it's easy for your child to develop a weight problem. So I would look to see what you have around the house to eat and make sure that it's healthy food. A second is aerobic exercise. Aerobic exercise is not only good for physical health and for weight control, it's also really good for the brain. And one of the things I discuss in the book is that it is really a problem that our schools have cut so much physical education out of the daily activities of kids. Aerobic exercise is one of the most important things we can do at any age for brain health. So it's really important that every adolescent gets enough physical exercise, an hour a day, really. And then the third is sleep. I mean, we know that our adolescents are sleep deprived. An adolescent should be getting about 9 hours of sleep a night. I know very few who do. Part of the problem is that our schools start too early. A lot of people have been saying that for many years.
And another thing is to the electronics around the bedroom.
Exactly.
The phone is pinging and dinging, and there's the computer's on, and so perhaps parents should put their collective feet down and say after 11 o'clock everything goes off.
That's right. And we know that inadequate sleep contributes to obesity. So that's another reason among many to make sure that your adolescent is getting enough sleep.
But sometimes in a parent-child relationship, if you want your child to change a certain way, and for the better, for the child's health, it can be really hard because the child knows this. But at the same time, you can lead them to, horse to the water. The horse is not necessarily going to drink, I think there's a complex relationship there.
There is. And that's why I think that sometimes what we have to do as adults is to structure the environment to take away the choices that we don't want our kids to make.
As opposed to constantly talking and nagging
and reminding, which doesn't work very well and which goes against, I think, the teenager's natural inclination to want to be independent and autonomous. So if you have rules about screen time, and you enforce the rules, that is probably going to be more effective than simply just explaining to your child why all the screen time is bad for his brain development and bad for his mental health. If you have healthy foods around the house and you also eat a healthy diet as a parent, that's going to be more effective than nagging your child about what she's eating and why she's having trouble controlling her weight.
Lawrence Steinberg is our guest. He is author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. And if you'd like to join the conversation, it's as easy as dialing 888-477-9499. Okay, let's get to peer pressure. And the best way for a parent to work with a child so that he or she is not necessarily influenced and prone to doing things that are negatively risky.
Well, this is something that's really hard to do. One of the things that my collaborator, Jason Chine at Temple University, and I have been studying is the impact of peers on adolescent risk-taking and risk behavior. And what we have found is that the presence of peers, even if they're not actually encouraging adolescents to engage in risky behavior, the mere presence of peers activates brain regions that make adolescents more reward sensitive, and it makes them more on the lookout for rewards and more attentive to the potential rewards of a risky choice and less attentive to the potential costs. I think most of us, thinking back to our own adolescence or watching our own teenagers, would admit that we did a lot of crazy things when we were with our friends that we would never have done by ourselves.
Uh-huh.
And what we're understanding now is what the brain process is that does that. We've even shown that we can make this happen in mice. I mean, we've done experiments looking at the behavior of adolescent mice compared to adult mice, and adolescent mice are much more affected by the presence of other adolescent mice than adult mice are by the presence of other adult mice. So, as a parent, if you can steer your child toward the kinds of peers you want your kid to be involved with, that at least is going to make this brain activation occur in the context of a peer group that might be steering your child to engage in more positive risk-taking than negative risk-taking.
Okay. We have an email from Karen. What do I need to know about teen brains to make them understand the seriousness of bullying?
Well, I think the most important thing to know about teen brains that's relevant to bullying is the fact that a system of the brain that we call the social brain is undergoing dramatic change during adolescence, and it's change that makes kids much more attentive to their social world. A lot of bullying is done to get the attention of other people. And so understanding that adolescents are very susceptible to the influence of peers and likely to change their behavior when peers are around can help us think about designing interventions to diminish bullying, because it is a terrible problem. And actually, face-to-face bullying is still a much more pervasive problem than cyberbullying, even though the latter tends to get more of our media attention.
And as we begin to wrap up the hour, we do have time for this tweet from Ron. I have 4 kids, ages 8 to 16, and screens go off at 9 p.m., except for computer for schoolwork.
A thumbs up to that. Yep, absolutely.
So describe mindfulness meditation and how it might help in self-regulation. Is that something that's easily taught to young people?
It is. And mindfulness is one of several activities that, it turns out, affect the brain for the better. Some innovative schools are now incorporating mindfulness training into their daily activities. So meditation is a very good way to do that. Yoga is another good way to do that. So during a time when we want to help people develop better self-control and more self-regulation, mindfulness is one of those things that's really going to help this process along.
And in closing, Lauren Steinberg, bullet points for raising children as they move through adolescence, some things that parents can take away from this conversation.
Three things I think that are really important. Be warm, be firm, and be supportive of your child's developing sense of autonomy and independence. But make sure you do all of them at the same time. If you're firm without being warm, that's going to make your child rebel. If you're warm without being firm, that's going to lead to a lot of problem behavior in your child. If you're not supportive in a developmentally appropriate way of autonomy and independence, you're going to stunt that aspect of your child's development.
And also, you have to learn how to start letting go.
You do, but you want to let go gradually, and you don't want to let that emotional bond weaken.
All right. Lauren Steinberg, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times. Lauren Steinberg is a professor of psychology at Temple University and author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. For more on Radio Times, visit our Facebook page, and you can also find our podcasts by heading to our homepage, whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Thanks for joining us. Hour 2 is on the way. Stay with us.